Start it. So this is the Generations of Heaven and Earth. We're doing a biblical view of world history, ancient history, from creation until the destruction of Jerusalem. And this is the 13th lecture, where it's kind of like an extension of the 12th lecture because there was too much material to fit in the 12th lecture. And so we're going from the time of Pompey, who was a Roman general who died in 48 BC and who sacked Jerusalem, down to the time of the actual destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So this is the time period of that Christ came into the world. So just to review, Judea had, they'd been under the Persians, but then they were allowed to rebuild the temple, and then Alexander the Great came, and he actually was kind to them. He didn't destroy Jerusalem or the temple. But when he died, they found themselves under the Seleucids. And the Seleucids had four kingdoms. You had the one in Turkey and Babylon, and then you had the one in Egypt, which was there. That family was called the Ptolemies, and they were fighting back and forth for about two centuries. And so Judea kept finding herself being conquered by one or the other. But then finally, around roughly 150 BC, you had the Maccabees who fight their rebellion against Antiochus Epiphanes, and they're able to get independence for Judea, and so the ruling is priest kings, called the Hyrcanids. They were descended from Judas Maccabeus, and so the ruling is both priests and kings, so they're not quite following the law of God, and they became gradually more and more corrupt. So by the time that Pompey comes along, the Romans have been gradually getting stronger. They're like a python. They're gradually controlling territory after territory in the Mediterranean. So unlike Alexander the Great, who's like, bam, I'm conquering the world in 3 weeks or 3 years, instead the Romans are like, piece by piece, over two centuries, we're gradually going to conquer everything. And that's exactly what they did. So Pompey comes along and he wants to introduce Roman rule to Judea, which was not under Rome. And he was actually in Syria at the time. And you have these two Hyrcanid brothers fighting over who gets to be the high priest and therefore the king of Judea. And the one who lost felt bad for himself, so he goes to Syria and he says, Pompey, will you please come and make me king? And so Pompey says, okay. So he comes in, and because this brother had a lot of followers in Jerusalem, they open the gates to him. He comes in, but the people in the temple shut the gates, so the Romans beat the gate down and they killed everybody in the temple. Sorry, I'm looking for my slide here. Oh, there it is. Here's an illustration of all the people. So they killed about 3,000 people in the temple and took the gold and said, oh, by the way, Rome is now ruling over Judea. So that was how the Hyrcanids and the Judeans lost their independence. It wasn't because they got invaded. It's because two brothers were greedy. They weren't following the Lord, and they invited their enemies in and opened the gates to them, and that's how they lost their independence. So, at this time, Rome was ruled by the triumvirate. You had Mark Antony, Julius Caesar, and Pompey, who together were basically like the three generals who formed the ruling council. But what happened was a civil war broke out between them. So Mark Antony, he goes down to Egypt, and he marries Cleopatra, who's the last of the Ptolemy dynasty. I think they had a kid. She had twins. There's a statue of twins that she had that probably were with him. So he fights this battle with Caesar, and eventually he loses, and I believe they both die. So now Caesar is the uncontested ruler of Rome, and he essentially replaces the rule of the Senate with the rule of the emperor. And he's the first emperor of Rome. And his friend Brutus, who was a true Republican, said, not an American Republican, but the Roman Republic. He believed in the rule of the Senate. He conspired with his friends, and they murdered Caesar because he had violated the rule of the Senate by establishing an emperor, himself as emperor. So that is, Shakespeare has a great play about that. So Julius Caesar, before he became the emperor, his title was Pontifex Maximus because he was the leader of the Vestal Virgins. The civil religion of Rome was the Vestal Virgins, who were these priestesses who kept this fire going all the time and did sacrifices to it. And then they had a man who was the high priest, which was a political position. And so Pontifex Maximus means the high priest in Latin. And today we have the guy who wears that title called the Pope. And he got it from there, which happened about 4 centuries later. Okay, so Caesar, he was a handsome-looking guy and had a really cool outfit. I mean, that kind of looks like the Gorgon Medusa on his chest, though. Okay. Okay, so this is a chart that shows in Daniel and in Revelation and in Matthew 24 and in Luke 23, we have a lot of discussions.
I'm sorry, laughing at your first.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, so we have 10, we're told that this beast that will crush everything else, that it has 10 heads or 10 horns. And these are the 10 horns of Rome. The first was Julius Caesar, and everyone's laughing because I said he invented Caesar salad, which isn't really, maybe he did, but I don't think it's true. So he died in 44 BC. Yes. So he's replaced by Octavian, who was related to him, but not his son. He takes the throne in 27 BC. And what's really interesting about these 10 Caesars is there was not a single father-to-son inheritance until Vespasian and Titus. So these three in the bottom that are in pink, they actually were not considered royal blood. The previous Caesars were often the Senate class. They were the highest class of Roman citizens, whereas Vespasian was a commoner. And so essentially, once Nero and Galba had died, the office of emperor switched to commoners and basically just army generals for the next 200 years until Rome collapsed. All right, so let's talk about what happened and how Herod came to the throne. So Herod was an Edomite. His father was named Antipater. And I don't know why they chose this name. It means against father, but it was a popular name in Herod's family. Well, so Antipater, he was kind of a schemer, and he made friends with the Romans, and he managed to get his son basically crowned as king of Judea by the Caesar in Rome in BC 37. So this guy Herod comes to the throne, and he's an Edomite. Well, you know the Jews hate Edomites. I mean, he's the son of Esau, and he couldn't possibly be their true king, according to them. So he marries the daughter of the Hyrcanid high priest. Remember the one who invited the Romans in? He marries the daughter, and that's, I believe her name was Salome, or Salome. And he has two sons with her. But he has a son, Antipater, is his son who was older from a previous marriage. So as far as the Jews were concerned, these two sons of Salome, they are the future of Judea and Israel because they are descended from the Hyrcanid high priest. The problem was Antipater was jealous. So he laid plans and he schemed and he connived and he convinced his father that these two young sons were scheming to overthrow him. And so Herod killed them both, and this is the year before Jesus was born. So he kills them both, and then right around this time, these wise men show up and say, hey, there's a king that's going to be born. And you can say that Herod was probably in a very bad mood to hear that. One other aspect of the politics of the wise men showing up and giving Herod this message is that during this time, as the 10 tribes had been taken into captivity. A number of them ended up in Asia. And some of them became a kingdom known as the Parthians. And the Parthians, they had Armenia was one of their provinces, which the Romans were always trying to, it was like their border territory, and they were always trying to control who was king over Armenia. And so it was Rome and Parthia that were competing over who would choose the king of Armenia. So the Parthian ruling class were called the Magoi, which was kind of like the Senate for them. And they apparently, according to some scholars, their kings were descended from King David. And they were very interested in keeping genealogies of who their kings were and who the possible people were who could become king, because being descended from King David, the Parthian kings were notorious for killing off all their brothers every time they became king. They kill off all the other guys in the family. And so then they have, when that guy dies, we've got to find a replacement. So around this time, they'd had a little bit of fratricide going on. And so this embassy of Magoi, according to the scripture, come riding on camels with gifts for this king that they're expecting to be born in Judea. And some scholars think that they knew exactly who Jesus was, that they knew that he was descended from David, and that they were looking to him as a potential possible claimant for the Parthian throne, which would have made Herod even more terrified of having this guy survive, because the last thing he wants is a potential claimant to the throne of Judea who also happens to have a superpower behind him, which Parthia was equivalent to Rome in terms of power. So Herod obviously was tricked and the wise men escaped, so he sends in the order to kill all the babies in Bethlehem, and Jesus and his parents escaped to Egypt, which had to have been a very short trip because Mary had to come back in time to have Jesus presented at the temple when he was 40 days old. So I think that was probably a pretty short trip to Egypt. And then Herod dies around 1 BC. And I realize this is a little bit different from some of the conventional chronologies. They say that Herod died in 4 BC, and that's based on a lunar eclipse. But there was also a lunar eclipse in 1 BC. And there's a good book by, Martin. He's got a book called The Star That Astonished the World, and he does a really good job on the chronology and makes a strong case that Herod probably died in 1 BC because of other constraints on the dates, which means that Jesus was probably born right in 2 BC. All right, so one other thing about Herod, he built all kinds of big palaces and big cities, and on the one hand, he tries to make the Jews happy. So he did this huge building project to rebuild the temple that ended up taking 49 years. Now, 49 years, why would that be a significant number to the Jews?
Seven times seven.
Yes, and remember the prophecy of Daniel about the rebuilding? He said the first sevens that the temple and the city will be rebuilt. So now you have a second 7x7 rebuilding of the temple. And it happens that this 49th year is the year that Jesus was crucified. And we're going to get to that. So Herod, on the one hand, he's rebuilding the temple, and he looks like a good Jewish king. On the other hand, he's building the city of Caesarea Philippi and three other Roman cities they had pagan temples and pagan rituals. And so he's basically playing both sides. He's playing the Jews, and he's playing the Romans. And it was very clear that Herod had no God but himself, right? And he viewed religion as a way to maintain power. Okay, so during this time, Caesar Augustus, his actual name was Octavian, and they started calling him Augustus, which means to be worshipped, or that's a word for a god. So he was the first Caesar that took the claim of to be a god during his lifetime. And they proclaimed the gospel of Caesar Augustus, which was the good news of Pax Romana, the Roman peace. So when Jesus and his disciples, when Jesus says, proclaim the gospel of the kingdom, he is directly taking the claim of the emperor, and he's proclaiming himself to be the true emperor. And if you read first century history, and you read the things the Roman emperors were doing and saying, and then you read what Jesus said, you realize Jesus was deliberately claiming to be the emperor. Jesus was getting right in their face and saying things that nobody would say unless they wanted to be killed, because he's claiming to be the ruler. So one of the interesting events in Octavian's life is that he sent one of the senators into Germania with an army to conquer the Germans. And they were killed in the Battle of Teutoburg Forest. Three legions were wiped out, never found. Actually, I think it took about 40 years. They eventually got all three of the standards back. The Romans, every legion would have a standard, which was a flag with a golden eagle that they prayed to. So that, like, the flagpole had an eagle on top. And that was their banner. And if they lost that, that was the ultimate shame. So they lost three of those. And it took them 40 years. They eventually kept sending people into Germany to beg, borrow, and steal, and they finally got them all back. But they didn't get them back by conquering anybody. So this Battle of Teutoburg Forest was the worst defeat in Roman history, with one other possible exception, in 390 BC. And when the news came back to Augustus, he banged his head on the wall. He was banging his head on the wall for hours, saying, bring me back my legions, bring me back my legions. So he was very, very upset that the man he had entrusted with this mission had lost his legions. But there would be another emperor. Actually, they gave up on Germany. They never tried to do Germany again. They went after Britain instead. Okay, so Augustus dies, and his nephew, Tiberius, comes to the throne of the Roman Empire. And Jesus came to his ministry during the years of Tiberius. And Tiberius was, for 2 years, he reigned as a co-regent with Augustus. And he was very successful as a general, but he had a very embarrassing problem that his wife was notoriously promiscuous. And so he was called one of the gloomiest of men, the Tristimus hominum. And later in his years, he went deeper into sexual immorality. So during his lifetime was when Jesus came and his ministry came, and we have the crucifixion and the resurrection. And one of the difficulties of history of this period is figuring out exactly which year was the crucifixion and resurrection. And two of the years that you'll most commonly see in Christian scholars and books of chronology and things is they'll say it was either the year AD 30 or it was the year AD 33. Now, AD 30, they say that it was that year because that was the year that the full moon happened on a Friday for the month of Passover. And then they'll say for the year AD 33, well, there was recorded that there was a solar eclipse in the month of the Passover. Well, both of these are erroneous for the reasons I'll share. First of all, does anybody know, could you have a solar eclipse on the full moon?
No.
You could have a lunar eclipse, but you couldn't have a solar eclipse. Solar eclipse can only happen on the new moon, not the full moon. And the Passover was always on the full moon. So the fact that they had a solar eclipse it does not mean that Jesus was crucified in the year 33. I think it's a reference to the fact that the sky became dark for 3 hours, right? But that's not the same as a solar eclipse. The reason why I don't think it happened in AD 70, there's several reasons, but I think I've mentioned before that the Roman week that we have today was not the week that they had in the first century of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That the Romans were using an eight-day week at this time period. They didn't adapt the seven-day week until the end of the first century. And the second thing was that the Jews were using a lunar-based week, and there are three references in Philo, who was the leading Jew of the first century, where he explains that the Jewish week began, the cycle of weeks for each month began with the new moon, and so that the Sabbath always fell on the 8th, the 15th, the 22nd, and the 29th of the month. So what that means is that calculating back our week system of Friday to the first century to try to figure out the year is going to give us an invalid result because they were using a different calendar. But we do have some other information that does make it very clear which year it had to be. One is that we have two pieces of information, one from Christ himself and one from the Jewish Talmud. Jesus said in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, they were talking about how great the temple was, and he says, I tell you the truth, these will all be torn down, and not one stone will be left upon another. And he goes on and he talks about all these things. And then he says to them, this generation will not pass away until these things have come to pass. Now, that's a reference back to Moses when the people of Israel were called to go into Canaan, they get to the border, and they said, ooh, giants, no way, we're not going in there. And God's punishment was, this generation will pass away in the desert, and when all of them are dead, then you can come into the promised land because you didn't believe me. And it turned out to be 40 years later, that generation had entirely passed away. So 40 years later, Joshua leads the people into the promised land. So you have this Jewish definition from that history of a generation is 40 years. And Jesus is giving them the reverse. Instead of saying, you'll all die before this happens, he's saying, this will happen before you all die. And so being patient and being generous, if he waited 39 and a half years, he would be giving them as much time as possible to repent, but still keep his word. But if he waited 40 and a half years, or 42 years, his word would then have fallen to the ground, because according to the Jewish mind, the generation passed away and it hadn't happened, right? So I think that we can say from that it had to have been less than 40 years between the crucifixion and the destruction of the temple. And the destruction of the temple was in August of AD 70, and the Passover of AD 31 was 39 and a half years before that. There's another piece of evidence that supports that as well. In the Talmud, the Jews record that for 39 years prior to the destruction of the temple, the Passover the gates in the temple opened themselves every night. The gates, they locked it up, and the gate was a symbol of security. And the gate just started opening itself at night. And the Jews viewed that as God saying that the Shekinah glory was departing from the temple. So that's just another chronological data point. Now, anyway, that's my opinion, and there's a few other scholars who agree with me and several who disagree with me, so it's not a point of great contention, but that's just my position on the matter, AD 31. All right, so a few years later, Tiberius dies, and the gospel is going into the world, and we get this guy named Gaius Caligula, who becomes the emperor. He was a very, very bad boy. He was just a very selfish, spoiled, rotten, wicked, wicked man, and he apparently grew up together with Herod Agrippa. They were childhood friends. And he was told that in Jerusalem there's a temple and it has no image of any god in there. And he said, what? I can't believe that. I insist. Send them a message to put an image of me in their temple immediately. And so he sent this image. He sent this message to the governor of Syria, was the one who had authority over Jerusalem. Well, the governor in Syria writes him back. He says, with all due respect, if I were to do that, the Jews would rise up against us. We can't do that. So Caligula writes back and orders the governor to kill himself for defying his wishes. But in God's providence, Caligula got murdered, and the news of his assassination reached Syria before his letter. So the governor was spared from having to commit suicide. So God thankfully took Caligula off the throne after 4 years. But this was kind of a taste of what was to come with Nero, which is when you have a very bad man who has unlimited power. So between Caligula and Nero, we have Claudius, who was the last good emperor. And he was good in many ways. Though he conquered Britain, he conquered Britain. But in the conquest of Britain, there was a British chieftain named Caradoc. That was the British name for him. The Romans called him Caractacus. And Caradoc was captured by, he didn't surrender. I think they tricked him. Somehow they captured him. They bring him to Rome in chains. And he had fought just an amazing campaign against them when he was outnumbered. He was kind of like the Robert E. Lee of the Britons at the time, right? So they bring him in chains to Rome, and normally the Romans love this. When the Romans have a war and we win and we get the leader, we bring him to Rome in chains, we parade him through the streets, we throw garbage at him, and then we let him make a speech and beg for mercy, and then we get to kill him. That's what the Romans were into. And so Caradoc comes, and he doesn't beg for his life. He comes before the Senate, and he gives them a speech, and he says, why should we surrender to Rome? Doesn't us being a free people and resisting Rome make the glory of Rome all the more that you were able to defeat us? And the Romans were like, oh, yeah, he's right. So they pardon him. They spare his life. And they kept him and his family there in Rome as hostages. Well, he had two children, Linus and Claudia, or Gladys was her name. And the emperor Claudius adopted Claudia as his own daughter, which was a thing that the emperors did sometimes. So she took the name Claudia. Now, we see these two people in the New Testament as Linus and Claudia. And when Paul says there are people in Caesar's household who are of the faith, that's who he's talking about. So Claudia was the actual daughter of the emperor, and Linus was, I guess, he wasn't really in the household of Caesar. And then you had Paul says in another place, give my greetings to Rufus Pudens, whose mother is also my mother. Now Rufus Pudens was the son of a Roman senator, and he married Claudia. And there is actually a... before he became a Christian, there is a somewhere up in northern France, they found a place where he had dedicated an inscription to the Roman gods when he was actually in the army. And then later he became a Christian. So, and apparently he was the son of Paul's mother. Paul's mother had remarried after Paul was born, and she married a Roman senator. And so Pudens grew up to be a senator. So they were actually meeting in church there, and the first church in Rome was called the House of the Britons, and because it was meeting in Caradoc's house. So that is the first Gentile church in Rome, and that's where it came from. Now, Claudius, he married, so Nero had already been born, and his mother was a widow, and Claudius married her. And when Nero got to be a teenager, and I guess figured he wanted to be emperor, he talked his mother into poisoning Claudius. And that's how Claudius died. Although it was never, you know, conspiracy theory. It's a Roman conspiracy theory from the first century, is that it's suspected that Nero got his mother to poison Claudius. So. All right. Well, I mentioned Caradoc already. We have a picture of him. I don't know if it's accurate or not. Okay. Now, Nero, he's the sixth head of the Roman beast. And we're told in Revelation that the sixth head of the beast would have a fatal wound but not die. And Nero, he starts off the first 10 years of his reign, he was relatively sane. He obviously had this wicked nature like Caligula, but he was restraining himself. But then around the year AD 64, it's like God just removed the restraints, and he went wickedly mad. So he wanted to build a new palace, and the problem was that there was a slum in the place that he wanted to build a palace, all these wooden buildings. So he comes up with a plan, and they start a fire to light the city on fire. And then they say that Nero fiddled while Rome burned, but actually he wasn't fiddling. He was reciting poetry and acts from a play. So he was basically entertaining himself and seeing this as a glorious thing as the city burns down and people are dying. And then he spread the rumor that the Christians started the fire and then began the Great Tribulation, which was the 42-month long persecution of the Christians that was prophesied in the Bible. That began when Nero lit that fire, and it lasted for 42 months until Nero killed himself. So during this 42 months, he just went totally loopy crazy. He decided to get married to a boy, and he dressed up as the bride. Nero dressed up as the bride and had a big thing where he got married to a boy. He was having garden parties where he would take Christians and had their mouths sewn shut so they couldn't scream, dip them in pitch, put them up on poles, and light them on fire to light his garden parties. That's how twisted this guy was. Of course, they were also killing the Christians in the amphitheaters by making them fight lions and such things. And then during this time, he really viewed himself as a suppressed artist. And so he goes to Greece, and he starts acting in plays, which the Romans found extremely embarrassing. Because the Romans viewed plays as something that only, you know, the men of questionable masculinity would do. And so you have Nero going to Rome, displaying all these openly non-manly tendencies, and then thinking that he's this great actor and playwright and singing operas and going around doing all this stuff. And the Roman Senate, while he's gone, is like, okay, how do we get rid of this guy? So they start planning a rebellion against him. Now, the first rebellion they planned against him was almost ready to be done, and it was found out the day before. And so Nero killed all the people that were involved, the first assassination attempt. Then a comet came, and they all were convinced the comet meant that the emperor would die, because that's how the Romans interpreted comets. So Nero, to prevent the comet from killing him, he sacrificed all of the noble Roman senators and people that he could find. So he used human sacrifice to try to avert his own death. And then finally, he ended up committing suicide when a rebellion began. The rebellion began in Spain and Germany. The governor of Spain was Galba, and the governor of Germany supported Galba's claim to be the new emperor. And as soon as Nero heard about it, he killed himself. But the word didn't get out that he had killed himself, and somebody who looked just like him gathered a bunch of people together, and he was running around Asia Minor, which is Turkey today, saying, I'm Nero, and I've been dethroned, and I need to get back on the throne. And the soldiers started coming to him, and the Parthians were getting ready to send an army to reinstall him as the emperor, until they finally figured out that he was a fake, and then they killed him. But then you had Nero survive. He appeared to have three fatal wounds: the comet, the assassination attempt, and then the actual. He killed himself, and yet appeared to come back to life again as the imposter before he finally was actually dealt with. Now, the events that happened, where you had Galba, who's the emperor, Galba is the governor of Spain, who started the rebellion, and then the governor of Germany, or the province of Gaul in Germany, supports him. The result was that the German legion killed that governor. And so after Nero dies, the Senate installs Galba to be the emperor. But now the German legion has a problem, because they just killed the guy who supported Galba, who's now the emperor, but they were trying to be loyal to the emperor. But now Galba's the emperor, and Galba did not appreciate that. Right? So he viewed them as of suspect loyalty. So Galba made one of the greatest mistakes in history, which also fulfilled a passage that was prophesied in Revelation. Galba had a senator named Vitellius, who, in Galba's own words, says his only god is his stomach. He's like the most unmanly man I could ever send it to lead soldiers. So basically, to punish the German legion, he sends Vitellius to become the new commander of the German legion. So Vitellius goes up there to Germany and Gaul, and he's just a live and let live, make love not war kind of guy. And he gets there and he says, oh, the soldiers are living in appalling conditions. I'm raising their wages, and I'm going to give you guys more rations. And the soldiers are all like, yeah! So 2 weeks later, they proclaim him emperor. And so now Galba is in Rome, and he just gets news that Vitellius has just declared himself emperor. And then the Praetorian Guard assassinates Galba, and the reason they did that was Galba was, I don't think he was Scottish, but he definitely had Scottish blood, because he was extremely tight with money. And when he was running to get the position of emperor, his supporters had promised the Praetorian Guard a huge raise in their wages if they supported his cause. But he didn't actually know about that. So he successfully becomes emperor, and then the Praetorian Guard, who are the emperor's bodyguard, it's like the secret service, they're like, okay, where's our raise? And he's like, I didn't agree to that. No, you're not getting a raise. And 2 weeks later, they were dragging his body through the streets of Rome. So, you know, you can be tight with money, but you got to really have sense about it. You got to have the people that are protecting your life, you need to make sure that you keep your word to them. And God will prove what happens when you don't. So, sorry, I guess I'm a couple slides behind. So Nero's death. Now, what's interesting about Galba is in Revelation, it says the seventh head of the beast will only be for a little while. And Galba only, he ruled for less than 7 months. He only managed to make it 3 weeks past New Year's Day. And in both the Babylonian and the Judean and the Roman culture, if you didn't make it through New Year's Day, you didn't really count in the king's list. It was bad luck. If you didn't live through New Year's Day, you weren't counted. Well, he made it through New Year's Day, so he was counted. But the two guys after him did not. And this is what began the year of the four emperors. So Galba was the first of the four emperors. Otho was the leader of the Praetorian Guard, who killed Galba and proclaimed Otho to be the emperor. But Vitellius was the leader of the German legion, the German and Gallic legions, who, incidentally, has anyone seen the film Braveheart? What kind of hairstyle do those Celtic warriors wear? What kind of hairstyle did the Celtic warriors wear? They had long hair, like women. And you wouldn't say that to their face. But that actually came from a German tribe called the Hatti. And they had this tradition that they couldn't cut their hair until they killed a man in battle. So their young warriors, they'd put them on the front line, and they had their hair down long like women. And they had to prove they were men by killing a man in battle, and then they could cut their hair. And so Vitellius is leading this legion with the long-haired men with long hair on the front line of his shock troops. So they come down. They're marching down south, and they march into Italy, and Otho and the Praetorian Guard are marching north. And they meet at a place called Bedriacum, and they have this battle. And Vitellius, he's got an army of veteran troops. And Otho's got the Praetorian Guard. Now, the Praetorian Guard are the guys who guard the emperor. And when was the last time they actually saw any action? Probably not, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. Well, Vitellius' legion makes short work of Otho's. The Praetorian Guard gets chopped up, and Otho kills himself. And then they gave the dagger to Vitellius, and he basically had the dagger placed in a temple to build a shrine to this. This is the dagger that made him the emperor. So Vitellius, though, he took his time. He did not go straight to Rome. He took his time. He took about 5 months, and he was going from place to place in Italy. They would basically show up with the army, take all the food, take the women, party, get drunk, do gross things, and then move on to the next place. And so he was basically, he's claiming to be emperor, but he's treating Italy like he's an invading army, and he's pillaging them. He's not killing the people, but he's definitely tormenting them. And I believe this is the fulfillment of the horde of locusts with long hair like women that would torment the people of the beast land for 5 months. So Vitellius finally gets to Rome, and he chooses to be inaugurated on a day called the Feast of Alia, and that's a very dark day in Roman history, according to Romans. So the only time Rome had ever been sacked in its history up to this point was in the year 390 BC. And in 390 BC, these two British brothers, Bran and Bel, or Belus and Brennus, as the Romans called them, they came from Britain with a big army, which was probably partly British and partly Gaulish from north France. They came down into Italy, and they sacked Rome, and it was called the Battle of Alia, and they later remembered it as the Feast of Alia, and it was the most humiliating day in Rome's history, because Rome got sacked by a foreign army. And so Vitellius chooses to be inaugurated as emperor on this day, and when he just marched down from Gaul with an army of guys with long hair, it's almost like he was reenacting Brandon Bell's sack of Rome. So needless to say, this made him a bit unpopular with the Romans. And during all this time, Vespasian, he's the general who was in Egypt at the time, and his son is Titus, and he was conducting the Jewish war, which Nero had started. I guess it started in the year 66. So Vespasian had completed the first 2 years of the Jewish war, where they defeated the zealots in the countryside of Judea, but they hadn't taken Jerusalem itself yet. So they've conquered the countryside, but not Jerusalem. And then this happens with Nero. So Vespasian goes to Egypt. It's like, okay, we'll pause the Jewish war. Let's figure out what's going on here. Well, he gets 10 legions to support him, and he sends his brother to Rome, and they basically they declare Vespasian to be the emperor, and if the Senate doesn't agree with it, we're going to invade Rome, was the basic message that they got. So there was a battle and a fracas, and Vitellius ends up getting killed. The Roman Forum gets burned, which was quite embarrassing to them. It's like the Capitol building getting burned down. But Vespasian gets installed as emperor, and then he gives his son Titus the job, finish what we started with Jerusalem. So this was the year of the four emperors, and Tacitus wrote about this year. He said that if we weren't ever sure about it before, we are now absolutely certain that the gods only care not for our happiness but for our punishment. And I believe that Tacitus was recognizing what the book of Revelation was saying, is that these are bowls of wrath. Jesus was avenging himself on the whore of Jerusalem, apostate Judea, and the adulterer, Rome, who she had committed adultery with. He was bringing vengeance on both. And this is, if you recall, in the New Testament, we have this passage where you have the woman caught in adultery, and she's brought before Jesus, and they want him to condemn her to death. And he says, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone," and they all leave because none of them is without guilt. And now a lot of Christians have taken that to say, see, that Jesus was changing the penalty for adultery. Adultery is no longer a death penalty offense. However, we get to the book of Revelation, and the first part of Revelation, you read the seven, the letters to the seven churches, and then you have this story about there's this little book with a seal on it, and nobody can open the seal. Nobody can open the seal, but then they find the Lamb is worthy to open the seal. The Lamb is worthy to open the seal. And he opens the seal, and what he reads are the seven judgments of the seven bowls of wrath and the seven, seven seals, seven bowls, and seven trumpets. Yeah. That's what's in the book. And what is he doing? He is the one who's worthy to cast the stone at Rome and Judea who committed adultery. And then later he talks about it when it gets to the part about the woman riding on the beast. She's the whore of Babylon. Okay, so I'm just pointing out that I believe that that passage of the woman caught in adultery definitely belongs in the Bible. It's not something that somebody added later. And that Jesus then later in Revelation and what happens in history, he is showing that if the person is worthy to cast the stone, that this is a crime that is worthy of punishing. Okay. So Vespasian, while he's down in Egypt, just before they make him emperor, really interesting, in Revelation we're told that this beast will do false miracles. And we have it recorded in Tacitus that while Vespasian was there in Egypt, they brought sick people to him, and he touched them, and he healed crippled and blind people. So that you had an actual Roman emperor, who actually was doing miracles in the name of the false god Serapis. Although it was implied that the priests were the ones who actually did it. Okay, so Vespasian has a son named Titus. Titus is a general, Prince Titus, he becomes. Sorry, I don't have a picture of him. While he is besieging Jerusalem, he's carrying on a relationship with Queen Berenice. Queen Berenice and her brother, King Agrippa, are the last two descendants of King Herod. who are ruling over Judea. And therefore, they're on the Roman side, because when the Jews revolt against Rome, they're also revolting against them. So what you have is the queen of Judea literally fornicating with the prince of Rome. They are like the physical picture that, of course, is symbolic on the much larger scale. It was the religion, it was the people of Judea who were fornicating with Rome, the power of Rome, the religion of Rome. So the way God is viewing this is, and he uses this throughout the Old Testament. He talks about how when the Israelites went after the Baals, they were committing fornication and adultery against him. And so you see the same thing here, but we actually have literally two people, the physical flesh and blood symbols, acting it out. And Titus ends up destroying Jerusalem. And he destroyed Jerusalem, I believe, 39 and a half years after Jesus said Jerusalem would be destroyed. So, this is a depiction of what it's supposed to look like. And then a couple years later, if you read David Chilton's Days of Vengeance, which is an excellent commentary on Revelation, he assumes that the focus is 100% on Judea. And I would say that it's roughly 50-50, because Jesus isn't just punishing Judea, he's also punishing Rome. And so Tacitus is writing about the punishments that Rome is feeling, and Josephus is writing about what's going on in Jerusalem. It's amazing that God gave us those two witnesses of this time. And so Pompeii, the volcano of Vesuvius, blew up and buried Pompeii and Herculaneum during this time period. And this is the time when Tacitus is basically saying, we had plagues, we had wars, we had civil wars, we had alien invasions, we had everything that could go wrong. The capital was burned, the emperor's killed again. It's like everything that could possibly go wrong has gone wrong. Surely the gods are judging us. And truly, indeed, I believe that Rome was receiving the wrath of God during that time period. So, almost done here. This is my very poorly drawn diagram. If this was creation and this is today, you have the Old Covenant, which is the red line, the Old Covenant with Moses and the sacrificial laws, and then Jesus comes and we have the cross. So the New Covenant began with the cross. So the New Covenant is beginning, but until the temple was destroyed, the Old Covenant was still there too. And so you have this overlapping time period of 40 years between the crucifixion and the destruction of Jerusalem, during which both covenants are there, and that is the period that the Bible refers to as the last days. And so people who read the Bible and read about the last days, not knowing history, it must be the end of the world. No, it's the end of the Old Covenant. It's the end of Judea. It's the end of what Daniel was saying, the end of the people, the people of Judea as the priests of the world. That it was their last days, it was the last days of the Old Covenant, and that we are now in the New Covenant. So Revelation is not a book about the end of the world, it's a book about the beginning of the covenant kingdom, and it's about the end of the Old Covenant. Smoke. All right. Yeah. That's artistic license. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that would be the end of my history class. The Old Covenant expires with the temple, and the New Covenant has begun to conquer the nations. And it would be really fun to do another history class for the next 2,000 years, but unfortunately, it looks like I won't be here for quite a while, as I'm leaving in 2 weeks, and I may be gone for about a year. So I will miss all of you very much. Well, you could come visit me in Europe. We could do on-site tours. Any questions today? Any questions? Okay. All right.